everybody. Welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm John Iderola. Today is going to be an absolutely gigantic show, both in terms of guests and also in terms of news. So we're going to be starting off in just a minute with the latest on the possibility of a second shutdown, the dispute over how exactly funding should be allocated to try to avoid that, and will there be a wall round 100 or whatever. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking in depth about income and wealth inequality from a couple of different angles. First off, Senator Bernie Sanders has put forward a pretty amazing new bill. We're going to break down some of the details and talk about how it might influence this conversation that we're having politically, nationally right now. Also, some more great quotes from someone at Davos. Yesterday, we showed you Dutch historian Rutger who actually, by the way, is going to be on the show next Monday. So he was talking about the need to change the conversation from philanthropy to taxes. There was also another awesome member of that panel that we're going to be breaking down some of their quotes in just a little bit. We also have another go at attempting to cut U.S. involvement with Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. That is going to be very exciting to see it develop politically. And along the way, two great guests are going to be joining us. If you stick around in just a little bit, Emma Vigeland, correspondent for Rebel HQ, is going to be joining us and breaking down some of the recent big domestic political news of the week. And a little bit later on, extremely important environmentalist Bill McKibben is going to be joining us to talk about a Green New Deal. By the way, a bill is forthcoming on that. And some of the presidential candidates' positions on the environment and climate change and how important that conversation is going to be going forward in the 2020 Democratic primary. But first, we start with national news. We're just days out from the last government shutdown. In a couple of weeks, we face the possibility of an additional shutdown. And so as we get closer to that point where we might enter into another shutdown, it is very important to try to figure out what exactly Donald Trump is thinking about immigration, border security, the chance of getting a wall. And here is what we're going to do. We are going to use all of the available information to try to patch together an image of Donald Trump's thinking about thinking on this topic. And I am going, this is a bit of a spoiler, I don't know that we're going to be able to do it, even though he has said a lot on the topic. We're also going to break down what the recent Democratic statements are about the negotiations that are going on right now with the Republicans about the possibility of averting another shutdown. First, though, Donald Trump has been on one this morning, and a lot of what he's been talking about has been about the border, about Mexico, immigration, and all of that. Here are a few of the things he said. And as we read these, I want you to try to figure out, does Donald Trump think we need a wall? Does he think we already have a wall? Does he need funding for it? Or does he not need funding for it? And we're going to try to figure that out. So first he says, large sections of wall have already been built with much more either under construction or ready to go. Renovation of existing walls is also a very big part of the plan to finally, after many decades, properly capital secure capital our capital border. The wall is getting done one way or the other. So, if you've been following along with this, and if you believe that we do need a wall, you might understandably leave that tweet thinking, oh, okay, so we've already got a bunch of the wall, and it's going to be built no matter what. And so, I've been hearing on the news about the Democrats and the Republicans going back and forth about funding, but I guess that doesn't really matter because we already have a bunch of it. And it's going to be built one way or another. It's also got a new name, wall, in all caps. Okay. Now, bear in mind, as we were going through that, there had been this weird conversation during the shutdown about what the border, like the physical barrier at the border was supposed to be called. So depending on the day, it was steel slats or a concrete barrier or a wall or a fence or God knows what. And in fact, Kellyanne Conway took the media to task for calling it a wall, saying you're trying to make the border barrier a four-letter word, which it is. It is four letters and all of them are capitalized. So she was mad about that. And now, just a couple of days later, he tweets this. Let's just call them walls from now on and stop playing political games. A wall is a wall. But you just sent out your surrogate to argue that calling it a wall is a ploy. It is propaganda to turn the people against border security. And now he's doing it. So I guess it's a wall again. I don't know. Now, a little bit more on the negotiations going on right now in Congress between Republicans and Democrats. The president weighs in, I'm sure helpfully, saying, Republicans on the Homeland Security Committee are wasting their time. Democrats, despite all of the evidence, proof, and caravans coming, are not going to give money to build the desperately needed wall. I've got you covered. Wall is already being built. I don't expect much help. Wall is already being, like, come on, how do you still support this guy? But fine, okay. So right now, the people that stuck with Donald Trump on the Republican side through this shutdown, despite the fact that it was going to hurt their approval ratings, it was going to hurt their chances of being reelected because of how much damage they took through this shutdown fight, they're in there right now with Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats trying to get the funding that he has said that he has convinced so many of their followers is necessary. And while they're doing that, they're literally meeting today. Donald Trump goes on Twitter and says they're wasting their time, they're not going to get the money, and maybe it doesn't matter after all. Okay, now, again, now, by the way, bear in mind, we've read three tweets. So in the third tweet, we desperately need a wall that will be built. In the first tweet, it's already mostly built, and it's going to be built no matter what, so don't even worry about it. So depending on which moment of the day it is, if you're a Trump supporter, you have a difficult mental task at hand to try to figure out what are you supposed to be concerned about? What are you supposed to be pushing for at this point? But there is a little bit of fear-mongering added on top of it. Trump says more troops being sent to the southern border to stop the attempted invasion of illegals through large caravans into our country. We have stopped the previous caravans and we will stop these also. With a wall, it would be so much easier and less expensive being built. So again, now it's already being built. So I guess I shouldn't be worried about it. I guess I shouldn't call my senator or my representative if I'm a Republican. And also, we're back to the caravans. Now history is being rewritten and the caravans were stopped. So you may not know that. The caravans got all the way through South America, Latin America to the border and were stopped. But we desperately need a wall to stop them even though we've already been stopping them. Again, I can't follow it. And by the way, that didn't even happen. Now the caravans stopped being a topic of conversation after the election because it never really was one. It was never close to our border. It was never going to push through our military, wall or no wall. Fox News just stopped talking about it. Donald Trump just stopped talking about it because it no longer was a useful thing to try to motivate their base in advance of the midterm elections. But now the president of the United States is lying to the country saying that we thankfully stopped an invading force multiple times from crossing over the border. So the reason that all of this is important is that we have a State of the Union coming up. And it seems likely that Donald Trump, if he learned anything from the last shutdown battle, going by what we have out of him today, has forgotten those lessons. And going into a State of the Union in just a couple of days, that is potentially dangerous because he is once again being advised to declare a national emergency. And if he thinks that the Democrats aren't going to give him the money that, depending on when you talk to him, he either needs or does not need, he might take that opportunity to, with the eyes of the nation on him, declare that national emergency. And by the way, today, both coming out of the House Senate Conference Committee and in a press conference with Nancy Pelosi, multiple different statements coming out of the Democratic Party saying that there is not going to be funding for a border wall, no matter what is given, no matter what happens in these negotiations. That sets the stage potentially for a very exciting but potentially tragic and dangerous State of the Union next week. Okay, with that, we are going to take our first break. We come back. Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is going to be joining us. We're going to be talking about AOC, the border dispute, Howard Schultz, and more after that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Yes. Okay, so obviously this is the damage report on a regular episode. We've got a lot of bad news, unfortunately, for you. I do have some good news, though. We're joined now on the show by correspondent for Rebel HQ, Emma Vigeland. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Good to have you here. And also, I want to give people a heads up that I believe next week you're actually going to be in Los Angeles and you will be co-hosting the show live in studio next week.
Yeah, we're going to be hanging, having a great time. I'm really looking forward to it.
I am as well. And let's give people a little preview of what they can expect then with a few topics that have been in the news this week. First of all, I was just talking about the State of the Union, some of my expectations for what Donald Trump might use it for. Considering what's going on, what do you think he will do with the State of the Union next week?
He is getting increasingly angry that his wall funding is not going to happen. Nancy Pelosi has made it quite clear that she is not going to fund the wall. No package that the House sends out will have any wall funding. They'll do border security, the drones, whatever he wants in that realm, basically, but there's going to be no funding for the wall. She's made the, I think, correct political calculation that it is a very unpopular issue, the wall. No one really cares. A small fraction of the country wants to use that $5 billion plus money for the border wall funding, and the shutdown has only hurt Trump. Now, we will see on February 15th if Trump chooses to close the government again to secure the funding for the wall, but that would be very unwise. However, he's a very unwise man. And we will also see if he chooses to declare a national emergency, which is what Ann Coulter has been screaming from the rooftops about.
Well, that's actually what I'm curious about. I mean, he is going to have probably his biggest single media moment, at least for the next quarter or so, when the State of the Union happens. What do you think the odds are that he declares a national emergency during the State of the Union?
You're asking me to calculate odds for Donald Trump. That's really tough because he comes out of left field every other day. So I think that there's a good chance, but I don't think he will. I think that he will continue. He's lied about the fact that there is wall construction happening. I mean, that he's not even being truthful to his supporter. He's saying that a good portion of the wall is already being constructed, which is factually false. Mm-hmm. So he can continue to lie about that, I guess, and his supporters will eat up whatever he says. So I think this could be like one of his failed businesses where he just gets out of it by talking his way out of it and changing the subject. And hopefully for him, since the government has been reopened, the media will focus less on his lies in this realm, and he can obfuscate and distract in a different way.
So we also have a couple of new presidential candidates or possible candidates that have been announced over the past week or so. Obviously, the most important, Howard Schultz. He's now been running for a few days, or he's, you know, floating a trial balloon or something like that. So far, how would you say he's been received, and what has his entrance into this race sort of changed about the nature of this 2020 race?
I like how you were super straight-faced when you asked how he's been received. I mean, it's been a complete disaster from start to finish, and I'm enjoying watching the train wreck, to be honest with you, because he has this billionaire arrogance that is so off-putting. Why do you think you can run the country? It is so crazy how these very rich people, I mean, Hillary Clinton included, but she has a lot of experience in government, so we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But they get these consultants who tell them whatever they want to hear. And the fact that this guy thinks that there's someone who's hankering for a centrist who stands for nothing except for tax cuts for the rich, a centrist who wants to bring the parties together by being more corporate. No. The problem is that the parties are too corporate. Trump won by being a faux populist. Bernie Sanders got a lot of popularity for being a populist. Mm-hmm. He is the exact wrong kind of independent candidate. He's the worst of the parties that personified pretending like he's some sort of different kind of candidate. And it's deeply depressing that this our political system incentivizes this kind of person to think that he has a shot because he can buy his way into the national conversation. But I also think it's encouraging to see how poorly he's been received and how easy it is for someone like Elizabeth Warren to dunk on him.
Yeah, yeah. And although we do have to acknowledge that while, you know, Twitter has effectively dunked on him nonstop now for several days, people in the media, I mean, they very seriously talked about the chance that he could have to actually make a difference in this race. He was immediately on The View like the day after he announced that he might be running.
John, I'll just add that I think that he is the cocktail circuit of wealthy people personified as a presidential candidate. Parents, you know, or rich older people talking about how there's not enough compromise in Washington, except we just want our taxes to be cut. He's the direct result of those conversations and that just kind of vomit-inducing culture.
So here's what I'm curious about, though, because ever since he announced that he might run, the concern has been, and it's been stated in different ways, that he will split the vote, or that he'll take enough of the vote that it'll matter over and above what, you know, I don't know, the Reform Party will get this time around or something like that. But also, Fox has been specifically saying he will split the leftists. And I haven't really understood that because he doesn't seem to hold any appeal to those actually on the left. Do you think that there is a chance that if he sticks with it, he stays in the race, he's able to hire a million consultants to help craft his brand, will he actually be able to draw any real progressives into supporting him?
Absolutely not. I mean, real progressives will spit in his face metaphorically. Obviously, we're a pacifistic brand, but he could draw some people away from the center, which is concerning. I mean, I'm not, as much as I'm enjoying making fun of him, I still think the threat of him pulling some people away from say Bernie Sanders is the nominee. And there are a lot of people in the country that think he's too far left. I disagree, but they could go to someone like a Howard Schultz. And that's why I think someone like Kamala Harris is gaining a lot of steam right now. There's this desire to get back to stability. That's a whole separate conversation. But I think if someone like John Kasich enters the race and decides to run as an independent as well, we have less to worry about. But if Howard Schultz is the only independent and he's continuing to purchase media time for himself, I think Democrats should be concerned.
Yeah. Okay, well, we will certainly be tracking that. In New York, so we have to give you credit for the fact that you were perhaps the first journalist to pay serious attention to what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was doing in the very early stages of her primary, and you were in contact with her throughout that process. Now, sort of oddly early in this next cycle, there's the possibility that she might face a primary because a report, I think, in either Politico or The Hill, talked about some New York Democrats who wouldn't go on the record saying that they are interested in primarying her this next time around. Based on your experience with her and what's going on in New York right now, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, it's either Politico or The Hill, right? Like, that's the kind of publication that would publish the story from an anonymous Democratic lawmaker who says that he or she, a congressman, is actively searching the New York City coalition for someone who will primary Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, as true principled leftists, we are not upset about primary challenges, and AOC will crush whoever primary challenges her. She is the most exciting candidate in the country, right, or politician in the country right now. She's captivated voters. I mean, there was some poll, it wasn't the Washington Post, but they posted about it, that if she was of age, over 70% of Democrats nationally would like her to run for president and would consider her a good candidate for president. And that's outside of a very blue district in New York 14, where she now has enormous name recognition, probably more name recognition than any congressperson in the country outside of Nancy Pelosi or someone like that, maybe even more, to be honest with you. So it would be a fool's errand, but I am so amused by who they're floating to run against her. The Hill article reported that the congressman said that Elizabeth Crowley, the cousin of Joe Crowley, would be a good candidate because she's a woman and has really gone up the ranks within the Democratic Party establishment in New York, which means nothing. She hasn't earned, and saying that there are a lot of people who deserve that seat more. Really, there are people that deserve the seat more than the person who actually won. I'm shocked that that's your perspective, except the deserving is all about, putting in your time with the party leaders as opposed to actually running an insurgent campaign that speaks to the people.
Yeah, and as she pointed out on Twitter, the Congresswoman AOC pointed out that that's the traditional way of doing it. Instead, you can go out and you can earn it by organizing and getting people fired up about your candidacy. And I agree with you. We're in favor of primaries. I think everyone should be primaried. Some might not be as successful as others, though. So if any of the cousins or brothers or neighbors of Joe Crowley want a primary, or they are free to try to do that, I guess. In any event, Emma Vigeland, thank you for joining us, correspondent for Rebel HQ, and also will be in LA next week. We're going to be very excited to have you here in studio.
Thanks, John. Super excited to be there.
Thanks, and we'll see you soon. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more dispatches from Davos, a few rogue voices inside of that forum actually pushing for more taxation and more dignity for the working class of America after this. We are now on the verge of the first Green New Deal bill being introduced in both the Senate and the House. And joining us now to talk about the latest on the Green New Deal, climate change, and more, famed author, activist, and environmentalist Bill McKibben. Bill, welcome back to the Damage Report.
John, good to be with you as always.
Very glad to have you here, especially right now for a number of different reasons. So there's a bunch of different things that I want to talk about. I was curious about one thing, though. Obviously, there's some really horrendous weather affecting a significant portion of the country right now. A big debate going on about how much we actually know about the connection between the polar vortex, how it's evolved in climate change and things like that. But the president did weigh in earlier this week, sort of mocking those who are concerned about climate change as we were just about to be hit by this wave of horrendous weather. How did you respond to that?
Look, I mean, you could spend your whole life trying to respond to President Trump and correct his ignorance on every possible score. At a certain point, I don't think it's all that useful because, frankly, I can't imagine who's left really paying serious attention to him on issues like this.
Well, I certainly hope that you're right. So let's move from ignorance to irresponsibility. And that involves a story that broke last week by Bloomberg about a number of different corporations, including Merck and Apple and Home Depot and others that are developing plans to monetize climate change. Not to monetize stopping climate change, but to monetize the negative effects of climate change. What did you think about that reporting?
It was instructive as always. I mean, people will have read perhaps Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, and it seems more apt with each passing day. In fact, this was almost a parody version of it, reading that Merck was looking forward to the money they could make from pills to deal with all the diseases that you get when you unleash mosquitoes and bad water and things around the world. It's science fiction, but it's the world in which we live. That kind of disaster capitalism we've seen from Puerto Rico to Katrina to the wildfires in California, it's obviously gross, but it's a symptom of precisely the larger scourge we're dealing with here.
And it's interesting that this is operating in the background as there's still people who don't believe this is happening, that we're not experiencing any sort of ongoing trend in terms of climate. But the Pentagon is concerned about it. All of these corporations are concerned about it. All of the people that the right looks up to and admires, they're taking it seriously. But it hasn't trickled down to the regular conservative politician or voter, unfortunately.
Well, look, actually, at this point, the polling data is pretty remarkable. It shows that over the last few years, the percentage of Americans really worried about climate change has gone way, way up, and gone way, way up among Republicans as well as Democrats. At a certain point, it's like, who are you going to believe, Fox News or your lying eyes? Almost every county in America has had a federally declared disaster in the last few years. People sat and watched those firestorms sweep through California. By the time that was done, no one was under any illusion that we were living in the old normal. We're living in something very different now.
Yeah. So recently, a number of different politicians, including some who are going to be running in the Democratic primary this time around, have announced that they support a Green New Deal. And in some of those cases, there hasn't been quite a lot of details about exactly what they mean when they say that. And so I'm curious, from someone with as much experience as you have in this movement, when someone says they support the Green New Deal, what does that need to include for it to be a meaningful statement?
Well, that's just the right question. I mean, it is good that everyone feels the need to say it. And it's a good sign of the great organizing that's gone on from groups like Sunrise Movement and so on. But the bills that people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie and others are working on and beginning to present, Ed Markey, the common denominator is a recognition of the urgency and the scale of the problem. The urgency reflected by the fact that they envision basically weaning us off fossil fuel in very short order, a dozen years. The scale indicated by the fact that they envision, in essence, giving a federal job to anyone who wants one to make this transition work. Because, John, it's going to take a lot of hands to make this work. And so I think those two things will be the biggest hallmarks. The other thing that's obviously important is not just providing renewable energy, but keeping dirty energy in the ground. And I imagine that'll be a part, already is, of these things as they're emerging.
You know, it's interesting, as you talk about urgency there, and obviously that needs to be a part of this response. I wish that more of the public felt the sense of urgency and passion on this issue. But I know that AOC recently has been mocked for citing this 12 years that we have to get started on actually dealing with this and make sure that we approach it in the way that we should. Some people, there seems to be two philosophies. Some people think that if you try to wean us off of fossil fuels, go carbon neutral in a short period of time, you might scare people away. It's too difficult. Whereas she keeps comparing this quest to, like, for instance, reaching the moon, defeating the Nazis, all of these major things that we've been able to do. In terms of being able to sell this, which side do you think is going to end up winning out?
Well, A, I think she's right. The right way to sell it is to talk about the fact that we can do this, that we've done things on this scale before, that we're capable of it. But B, whatever you think is the right way or the wrong way to sell it, the point is that she's correct about the physics. We have to get this done in very short order. The correct time, would have been to start 12 years, 24 years, 36 years ago when we first found out about this problem. Since we didn't, we now have very, very little room in which to maneuver. Because remember, it's not a political problem like the ones we're used to dealing with. It's not a back and forth between two different interest groups that you settle on for the moment and come back 5 years later to cut tax rates or raise benefits or whatever it is. This one is a fight between human beings and physics, and physics is completely uninterested in compromise, doesn't care whether it's happening too fast for our liking, so on and so forth. It just does what it does with the carbon we put in the atmosphere, and that is the absolute bottom line of this debate.
You know, I would love that last paragraph of what you were just saying right there should be a part of the pitch to the American people about the Green New Deal, that physics isn't interested in compromise is very difficult to argue against, although I'm sure the Republicans will try. In any event, Bill McKibben, thank you so much for joining us once again on the show. We really appreciate you being here.
John, a real pleasure, and thanks for all your good work.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Davos, a strong voice arguing for more wealth and income equality. And Bernie Sanders, he has a new bill out addressing the estate tax. Pretty bold proposal after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We turn now to some important perspectives on economic and wealth inequality across the country. The Davos forum this year has been largely unbearable. A lot of the quotes, the sort of mocking condescension towards AOC, or even a sort of hypothetical conversation about raising top marginal tax rates, people just luxuriating in their wealth and privilege as they talk about them being stewards of potentially fixing some of the world's problems. that can be a little bit much. But there have been a few standout voices that have been very reasonable and have maybe made the whole thing worthwhile. And yesterday we profiled Rutger Bregman, a Dutch historian, who talked about how we need to move past this conversation about philanthropy and talk about taxes. He said specifically, taxes, 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 all the rest is BS in my opinion. And that is just great. He is actually going to be on the Damage Report next Monday, I believe. And we're going to talk to him about all these topics, his book and more. But at that panel where Rutger sort of went viral, there was another awesome voice. And that was Winnie Binyima, an Oxfam executive director, who responded to a concern by, I believe, Yahoo's CFO about how the people on the panel were being really unfair about taxes. And here's that interaction.
I actually came because I do believe we have an issue here. But I have to say, honestly, this is a very one-sided panel. You know, frankly, what people really want, what really want is a dignity of a job. I'd like for the panel to talk about beyond taxes, which every one of you have talked about. The only thing you've talked about in this whole panel on inequality, what can we really do to solve and help solve inequality over time beyond taxes?
Let me tell you something. We're talking about jobs, but the quality of those jobs with poultry workers in the richest country in the world, the United States. Dolores, one woman we work with there, told us that she and her co-workers have to wear diapers to work because they are not allowed toilet breaks. This is in the richest country in the world. So don't tell me about low levels of unemployment. You are counting the wrong things. You're not counting dignity of people. You're counting exploited people.
So that is just awesome. And by the way, Director Binyima might also be on the Damage Report next week. We're working on getting a day where she can talk to us. But that is exactly right. And watching that, once we'd gotten past the Dutch historian, thankfully her comments were also videotaped. It's a reminder that we do need to look at this topic from a number of different locations. Look, I love data. If you watch the show, you know that it's true. I love a good chart and you know, all that infographic and all that. But those numbers, while they can reveal certain things, they can also hide other things. And we can become so wrapped up in, you know, stock prices or unemployment rates or even job growth, by the way, can really hide more than it reveals in some cases. And so she talked there about poultry workers in the US needing to wear diapers. But it's not just poultry workers. We know that people who work in the warehouses of Amazon are facing horrible conditions as well. Just recently, we went through a great reminder that hundreds and hundreds of thousands of government workers are sort of possibly contingent indentured servants at some point, obligated to work to keep their job, but not obligated to be paid for the work that they actually do. Now, these are just tiny little dots, blips across the landscape, but you can find this in all different places, places where we have gotten to the point where if you have a job, or that if we had an obligation at all, the obligation is now achieved. We have given you all that is needed there. Now, bootstraps, become wealthy. You know, achieve the American dream. You've got your position. And even if you're working a job, even if you're working a full-time job, that does not mean that you are going to earn any sort of respect from the people with the power and influence in this country. I mean, look at the people who are working one or more full-time minimum wage jobs. They are all talked down to constantly as holding positions that should only be held by high schoolers or maybe those who are working, you know, sort of part-time while they're in college or something like that. These are people who are out there trying to live the American dream. They are working, but the system has been set up in a way that makes it very difficult to actually get ahead. And so we can't just look at these big macroeconomic numbers of unemployment and things like that. We need to look at the lived experiences of the working class Americans working in these actual positions and make sure that they're not just employed, that they're not just earning a good wage, but that they're respected in the way that they deserve to be for the work that they're actually doing for this country. Okay? They don't need us. We need them to have the society that we want to have, and they deserve respect for that, as well as economic opportunities. So great quotes there from Oxfam Executive Director Winnie Binyima. Hopefully, we'll be able to talk to her more about this and related topics in the very near future. Turning now to a different topic. Senator Bernie Sanders has not yet announced that he is going to run for the presidency, but he is making a lot of moves recently that are both in their own terms, good political moves, but also possibly an indication that he'll be running soon. And that includes today, breaking news, a new plan from Bernie Sanders, and that is a plan to expand the federal estate tax on the wealthy, to get it back towards, in some ways, close to where it was for literally decades over the course of the last century, in other areas to actually go beyond what it has been in recent memory. This is the For the 99.8% Act, and it would raise taxes on the estates of the 0.2% of Americans who inherit more than $3.5 million, while the rest of the country, quote, would not see their taxes go up by one penny under this plan, according to aides to the Vermont Center. Now, he's a great communicator on these sorts of issues, so I'm very glad that he and his aides are right out there being very clear that though if you watch Fox News, they're going to attempt to convince you that any sort of estate tax would affect literally anyone. But they're actually showing the numbers of the percentage of people that would actually be affected by this on a yearly basis, and it is obviously very small. You're talking about 0.2%. Now, what would this actually achieve? How would it be implemented? The plan would restore the 77% top estate tax rate that was in place in the U.S. from 1941 to 1976, tax estates worth more than $3.5 million, and create several new estate tax brackets, including a 55% rate on estates worth more than $50 million. So I apologize, that's a lot of numbers. Basically, what is going to happen is that for like the middle third of the last century, those with the largest estates, so here we're not even talking about the people who have who are going to inherit $3.5 million or $5 million, it's much more than that, would be taxed at 77%. That is a historically consistent level for the estate tax. And in fact, when the estate tax was originally set up under President Wilson, not only was it taxed at a higher rate, but it also affected far more people. It was initially implemented for people who had estates that were worth, in our dollars, $1 million. So it didn't take as much of a fortune to start to be affected by that. So now it would be sort of a sliding scale where the more wealth accrued by the family, the higher rate that it would be taxed at. That lowest bracket where it would start at $3.5 million, I believe is between like 40 and 45% of a tax, something along those lines. And obviously through the process of trying to get this passed, much of that could potentially be affected. But I want to put this in context of the conversation around the estate tax that's been going on nationally over the past few years. Understand that just this week, three top Republican senators released a plan to completely eliminate the estate tax, which the GOP already significantly weakened back in 2017 with their tax law, which made it so that it would only apply to those with more than $11 million or $22 million for couples, effectively meaning that although they did not eliminate the estate tax back in that tax bill, they made it so it would affect far fewer people. You had to have a higher threshold of wealth for it to affect you at all. And sort of philosophically, what is the purpose of this sort of thing? What is it intended to accomplish? That's obviously complicated. We've reached out to the senator's office to get him on the show to talk about this topic. But as of 2017, the top 1% owned about 40% of the country's wealth, higher than any share since 1962. And I believe that the top 0.1%, you'll want to check these numbers, I believe owns as much as the bottom 50 to 70%, something like that. Now, these measures of wealth inequality, this is not consistent historically. It has been getting worse and worse decade by decade. It accelerated in the 80s and it's only gotten worse since then. Now, I'm not gonna bore you with decades of political science research about the variety of negative effects of income inequality. It is dangerous, not just for those who are left behind economically. It tends to, and although this is not the basis for good tax policy, it doesn't generally lead to great economic performance by those who inherit this wealth. That's sort of a side point. But in terms of its effect on democracy, increasing income inequality is one of the greatest predictor for political instability, and in fact, the fall of governments in a number of different areas of the world. As more and more of the population feels that they have no stake whatsoever politically in what's going on, they begin to pull back from democracy. That is destabilizing, and it has resulted in a number of different extremely dangerous and, in fact, violent revolutions in a number of different parts of the world. Now, you can contrast this with Senator Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax that we talked about earlier this week. That video is up on our YouTube channel. These are different strategies at getting at sort of a similar goal, and I am very much looking forward to, through the course of this primary process, these different plans being considered. I want multiple people on that stage when these debates get started talking about different ways that we can help to reframe the debate about taxes in this country. It is long overdue. That said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Yemen back in the news with both senators and representatives on the Republican and Democratic side pushing once again to end our involvement in that war. We'll give you the details on the other side. We are way overdue for America to pull its involvement in the already catastrophic and tragic conflict on Yemen, being perpetrated mainly by Saudi Arabia, but also a number of allies, unfortunately, including the United States. And thankfully, today we found out that Senator Bernie Sanders, also Mike Lee, Republican, we have to give him credit, and Chris Murphy, along with Representatives Ro Khanna, a friend of the show, and Mark Pocan, are reintroducing their bills in the Senate and the House to pull our involvement in that conflict. Now, if you pay attention to this topic, if you watch this show, you might think, wait, didn't they already get that in the Senate? And it is true that the Senate voted 56-41 back in December to pass a resolution that this same group of senators had pushed for to withdraw U.S. forces in or affecting Yemen, except troops fighting al-Qaeda and associated forces. It was actually the first time a chamber of Congress voted in favor of a War Powers resolution since the War Powers Act was passed back in 1973. That historical note left in case Michael Shore watches this. But at the time, Republicans still controlled the House, which means that although, in effect, very few would go on the record saying they were opposed to this, it was not able to actually get a vote. We did not actually get it at that point. Thankfully, the midterms happened, and now we have a Democratic control of the House, and so we have another chance to actually make this happen. So if this bill is passed, what will it do? It would direct the president to withdraw U.S. forces in or affecting hostilities in Yemen in the first 30 days, again, unless they are fighting al-Qaeda or associated forces. But now it has been strengthened to include defining hostilities as including aerial refueling of non-U.S. aircraft conducting missions in the civil war. Now, according to the U.S. military, they are no longer conducting this, they say. But Ken Klippenstein of TYT Investigates has done some digging around and shown that we are still very much involved in the Air Force of Saudi Arabia, doing not only training for some of the affiliated forces working with them, but also providing maintenance for those planes as well. I would like to see all of that included in this bill. Not doing the aerial refueling is a good thing, but if we are still making it possible for the Saudi Air Force to operate, to bomb indiscriminately the civilians of Yemen, then we bear moral responsibility for the outcomes of those actions. And we can't hide behind the fact that we're no longer pumping gas into the plane in the air. If we're involved, we're involved, and hopefully that will be a part of this. A couple of quotes from those trying to push this through in the Senate. Senator Bernie Sanders says, "Today we are coming together to address one of the great humanitarian crises facing the planet, and also, in a historic way, to make certain that the United States Congress reasserts its constitutional responsibilities in terms of war making. The U.S. should not be supporting a catastrophic war led by a despotic Saudi regime with a dangerous and irresponsible military policy." Also, quote, bringing up a very good point that I believe has been unfortunately moved on from by the most of the media. Representative Chris Murphy said, "The reason Trump administration officials present to us that we should continue our support for this bombing campaign is that the Saudis are an ally. What kind of ally kidnaps a resident of your country who is seeking our protection, brings him into a consulate, chops him up and makes him disappear? The nature of this alliance has been exposed." So it is very good to hear Jamal Khashoggi and the tragedy of his murder being talked about. Seemed like a big story. There were no consequences. Donald Trump got away with doing nothing about it. And unfortunately, much of the country has moved on. But thankfully, there are those in the Senate and the House that are trying to make something happen. Not directly as a result of that, but certainly affiliated with that tragic story. Now, we have gone over the numbers many times. If you are a devoted listener of the show, you're already familiar with the tragedy in Yemen. But I do want to just remind you of a few of the things going on for the people living there. This infographic put together by the Office of the DNI showing there that of a total population of 28.7 million people in Yemen as of back in December of last year, 22.2%, a gigantic percentage, are in need of some humanitarian assistance. You can see that more than half of the population lacks access to drinking water and sanitation. Virtually the same number are severely food insecure, meaning that there is both famine and lack of access to water. You can see there are millions of people at emergency levels right now. There is over a million cases of suspected cholera, diphtheria, millions of people being displaced from their homes inside of Yemen. This tragedy is only getting worse the longer it goes on. To whatever extent the U.S. can use its influence to do something about this, we are long, long, long overdue to actually accomplish that. And by the way, on top of all of those numbers, we do have to bear in mind the number who have already lost their lives. Estimates vary between 13,500 to 80,000. Of course, it is very difficult to even verify those numbers because of the instability and the situation in Yemen right now. So hopefully they're successful in the Senate and House side in getting this passed and forcing Donald Trump to sign it. Thank you to everyone who is watching the show. Thank you for those who've been doing reviews. I saw Apple Cobbler wrote that Brooke is such an interesting person. You get a perspective you don't get from other news shows. The show is like getting a massage for your brain, Apple Cobbler says. So thank you for doing that review on iTunes. Thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow to close out the week. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.